So, you know, I think this is a man who has acted with impunity for a very long time, who's not been held to account. He wasn't held to account by the press earlier. And now he's grown into this full-fledged monster. And the GOP created that monster by allowing this kind of rhetoric and this kind of assault on values and on rights, basic human values and basic human rights, to go on throughout the campaign.
We have to leave it there. Jody Jacobson, we have to leave it there. We will link to your piece at Rewire. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crybaby, produced and performed by Stageworks, Inc. Crybaby will take place at the Clinton Street Theater Friday and Saturday, October 14th and 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, October 16th at 2 p.m. Crybaby Live is a rockabilly musical homage to the John Waters cult classic film set in the 1950s in Baltimore. Again, that's Crybaby, the play at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, reminding you that the last day to register to vote is Tuesday, October 18th, for the November 8th election. With an Oregon driver's license or ID, you can register online by following the links at sos.oregon.gov. And this KBOO program has been also made possible in part by Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House Internet Services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net. And up next is your KBOO Evening News. And the KBOO Evening News produces a one-hour newscast every weeknight. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. Email Lisa Loving at newsdirector@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protesters have shut down all five of the tar sands pipelines carrying oil from Canada into the United States.
And Benton County, Oregon will have ranked choice voting on its ballot in November. We speak to grassroots activist Blair Beaubier about what could happen.
And the U.S. Court of Appeals rejection of the Native American community at Standing Rock has resulted in a complicated opinion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 11th, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. One of the biggest items on the ballot this November will be Measure 97. If it passes, Measure 97 will generate $3 billion of revenue for the state by increasing taxes on corporations. Governor Kate Brown supports Measure 97, saying that, quote, "It's time for corporations to pay their fair share." Opponents of the measure claim that the government can't be trusted to use the proposed funds responsibly. The nonpartisan Legislative Review Office reports that fewer than 1,000 of the 400,000 businesses in Oregon would be affected by the measure. Most of the affected corporations are headquartered out of state, such as Comcast, which is based in Philadelphia. But an interesting wrinkle appeared when the Yes on 97 campaign tried to air ads criticizing Comcast on TV channels controlled by Comcast. Comcast refused to air the ads until their name was removed. The campaign then changed the ads to take aim at other large corporations like Monsanto and Wells Fargo.
Community organizer Ibrahim Mubarak has a lot of irons in the fire these days. As a founder of the Right to Dream 2 housing camp in Old Town, Mubarak has tried to help find a permanent spot for the nonprofit to pitch its tents. The deadline passed for the camp to move, but the location picked for them by the city has been blocked by a court ruling. Meanwhile, Mubarak has been lobbied by wealthy developer Homer Williams to run the proposed Terminal 1 warehouse plan, which would also offer housing to the most vulnerable. KBOO News caught up with Mubarak this afternoon for an update on these two stories.
The update with what's going on with Terminal 1 is some of the social service agents, the academic is pulling out. Maybe they have too much on their plate. I don't know exactly why. However, I got an email saying that the lease has been approved for Terminal 1. But for Right to Dream 2, they gave us a six-month extension while they try to change the zoning from industrial to both, habitable for residents and industrial. And I'm questioning that if they can do that for Terminal 1 so fast, why they can't do it for peer-based rent operation like Right to Dream 2 to continue to help people to be successful and have a proper place where they can sleep.
It is confusing because we're talking about two separate things, but they're the same thing.
Yeah.
So is there something that you wish that everyday people listening to us right now might do to support your position?
Yeah. When a houseless entity that's governed and organized by houseless people, I think the neighborhood association shouldn't be so fast to call them drug addicts or rapists or violent people. I think you should go and visit the people that's trying to organize and see how you can participate, because this problem is not it's not the houseless people problem, they became houseless, but it's the way the government or the politics here is set up, where it's not enough affordable housing, and everybody that can't afford these housing now is living on the streets. And so we need to come with some type of common solution, all the house and unhoused, politicians and police, business people also, to see how we can combat this epidemic. We all want the same thing. We just have a different approach in doing it. And because somebody's approach is different than yours, don't mean they're wrong and you're right.
Like, so it seems as if the neighborhood associations, as soon as you do not have an address, boom, you're not a neighbor. Even though we found, studies have shown that a lot of the people live in houseless in neighborhoods lived in that neighborhood before they lost their address. So we're talking about your address versus is your neighborhood your home? And I'm not sure that I've seen a neighborhood association so far that has mobilized to actually welcome and help houseless people. Have you?
No, I haven't. I think the Cully neighborhood is starting that reach out, and I give them props and I thank them for at least trying. That's the same thing with Homer Williams and Don Maserati of Terminal 1. They at least trying to do something. They're trying to set an example. It may not be the best, but they put their foot effort in trying to help this situation.
Ibrahim Mubarak, Right to Dream 2, Right to Survive Radio. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening to KBOO. Always listen to KBOO. You get the unadulterated truth.
All right. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The rest of the world is obsessing over Clinton versus Trump. But over in Benton County, the electorate is taking up real political change. If passed by Benton County voters in November, Measure 2-100 would establish ranked choice voting as a new system for electing candidates. Here to talk about what it means is Blair Bobier of the Benton County Ranked Choice Voting Campaign. Thanks for coming in tonight, Blair.
Thanks for having me on KBOO.
Yeah, so can you first just explain what is ranked choice voting and why would we want it?
Sure. Ranked choice voting is a voting method where instead of voting for just one candidate, voters get to rank the candidates in order of preference. So they get to select their first choice, their second choice, and their third choice. It allows voters to do more with their votes. It gives them more power and control, and it addresses the problems of vote splitting or spoiler candidacies, so people don't have to feel like they're either wasting a vote or voting for the lesser of two evils. It's used in a number of places around the country and around the world. In California, San Francisco, Oakland, San Leandro, and Berkeley, I'll use it. Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota, Portland, Maine. Cambridge, Massachusetts uses a version of it. Australia's been using it for about 100 years for their national elections, and it's how Ireland elects their president.
How have voters in those municipalities responded to the change of taking on ranked voting?
Very well. There have been surveys and studies that show that people really like it, find it easy to use. And in places such as San Francisco, it has helped produce one of the most diverse city councils, the Board of Supervisors, they call it in San Francisco, that they've had in their history. And it also produced the first woman mayor of Oakland.
Do any municipalities here in Oregon use this, or will Benton County be the first?
Benton County will be the first.
Wow. So can you explain the difference between top two voting and the ranked choice?
Yeah, you know, without getting too much into it, top two is something that restricts people's choices in November, and ranked choice voting is something that gives people more choices. I think that's really the bottom line. Top two has proven to be really not successful in both Washington and California, which adopted it a little while ago. And California is really having buyer's remorse over top two.
So can you define what top two is for those listeners who don't know exactly what that is?
Sure. So with top two, what happens is all candidates from all parties run against each other in the primary. And then the top two vote getters, and only the top two vote getters, go on to the November election. So the reason that's an issue is that the top two vote getters can be from the same political party. So you can wind up, and those states often have, wound up with just two Republicans or two Democrats, and it really restricts people's choices and pretty much eliminates third-party candidates from the November election.
Is that, where does that happen here locally, the top two voting?
Well, there's actually kind of variations of it. So for example, I believe that Portland has kind of a top two primary, and ranked choice voting can actually work to replace a primary and roll it into just one election. Ranked choice voting has also been called instant runoff voting. So it's a way to have a runoff election all in one election.
So what is your vision for this measure? Like, what do you hope that this achieves in the long run?
Well, we've got an issue in Benton County in that there's no majority vote requirement to be elected to the county commissioners or the sheriff. So to define that, a majority is 50% plus one. And people don't realize that when someone can win an election with more votes than anyone else, which is just a plurality, that that's not a majority. And when that's an issue is when you have three or more candidates running. Let's just say you have three candidates running. One candidate gets 40% of the vote, and two other candidates get 30% of the vote. Well, the candidate who has 40% of the vote has the most votes of any one candidate, but 60% of the voters voted against that person. So without a majority requirement, that person with 40%, that candidate can win despite the fact that most people voted against that person. So by using ranked choice voting in Benton County, we will institute a majority standard to elect our representatives.
So how long have you personally worked to promote ranked choice voting here in Oregon?
For a long time, before my beard was turning white. So I've been doing it about 20 years or so.
And for someone who's been working on this campaign for so long, why is it taking so long for people to pick up this style of voting?
You know, the interesting thing is that it's been in the Constitution since 1908. Most people don't realize that. If you've got a copy of the Oregon Constitution handy, it's Article 2, Section 16. So it's been around for a while. It came in the great wave of progressive reforms in the early part of the last century. Women getting the right to vote, direct election of U.S. senators, the initiative and referendum system, and preference voting, as it was called, was part of that. I believe we're the first instance of a local grassroots initiative to get it on the ballot. So I think we're actually being really successful in terms of a movement, and that this is our first effort to get it on locally, and we succeeded gangbusters getting it on the ballot.
You know, can you talk a little bit more what you just mentioned about it being within the Oregonian Constitution? So what does it say in our Constitution? Because I admit I have no clue.
That's fine, because I sat down with a former Secretary of State at one point who also didn't know it was in the Constitution. So you shouldn't feel badly. I believe that in Article 2, Section 16, it says that voters can rank their choices in order of preference, and it also actually addresses proportional representation, which is a different type of voting system that's used in most democracies around the world. So we've really got some leeway in the Oregon Constitution, and we should start taking advantage of that, using more democratic forms of electing our representatives.
So when you're talking about this ranked voting, you're talking about how it brings in a diversity of candidates and such. So can you talk about third-party candidates and how this affects that? So maybe you can talk a little about, are there third-party candidates who are actually like in office right now?
Sure, all over the country. And I think that's something that the corporate media ignores. So I certainly appreciate the question here on community radio. There are, third-party candidates or independent party candidates, have grassroots party candidates all over the country and here in Oregon. So we have had Greens on the city councils in Salem, Corvallis, and Ashland. There's a Green judge in Benton County. The former president of the Corvallis City Council was Green. There's a Green member on the council now. In California, there have been Green majorities in a few towns. And there's a Green mayor in Richmond, California, a big East Bay city. And Gail McLaughlin is her name, and she took on Richmond. She took on the refineries in Richmond. And there have been people who have done a whole lot. Libertarians have offices at the local level, and there's a few third-party and independent office holders at the state legislative level as well.
So do you think that ranked choice voting will assist in third-party candidates getting a greater voice or representation here in Oregon?
Absolutely, and I think the voice is really the key thing, because right now candidates are not deemed viable because they're running on a third party. So, for example, for people who suffered through watching that debate the other night between the presidential candidates, wouldn't it just have been totally different if there had been one or two other candidates who could have focused on issues instead of the mud that was being slung back and forth? So I think the greatest thing that ranked choice voting will do will broaden the debate. Just getting new voices into the debate will change the debate. And then it certainly opens up the possibility of those candidates getting elected as well.
We're just about out of time. So I just want to have you tell voters, how can they either support or learn more about this ranked choice voting?
Well, they can go to our website, which is betterballotbenton.com. And if folks are in the Benton County area, we have two events coming up this Friday at the Corvallis Public Library at 6:00. We're having an open house. And then next Monday at 7:00 at the Old World Deli, we'll be ranking beer. You'll get to vote on which local beer is your favorite, and it'll be a fun exercise in voting.
So you get to practice.
Absolutely.
With very important Oregonian things, with beer.
Exactly.
You guys have the spirit. So just one more time, I want to make sure everyone gets that website. It's www.betterballotbenton.com. Well, thank you very much, Blair, for coming in. That was Blair Beaubier of the Benton County Ranked Choice Voting Campaign. Election Day is November 8th. It's coming up. So find out more by going on to their website or attending their event. Can you just give the details one more time?
Yes, thank you. This Friday at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library, 6:00, and next Monday, 7 p.m. at the Old World Deli in downtown Corvallis.
Go practice ranking that beer. Thanks, Blair, for coming in.
Thank you.
Students across the country returned to school today after celebrating Columbus or Indigenous Peoples Day. But in Chicago, many people expected classrooms to remain empty. The Chicago Teachers Union was set to strike unless they reached a contract agreement with Chicago Public Schools. But at the 11th hour, they reached a tentative agreement. The nation's third largest school district avoided a walkout. Reporter Ariel Zayant with Free Speech Radio News has more.
It wasn't easy, as you all know.
Just before the midnight deadline, Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis walked into a sea of media. She announced that after nearly 2 years of negotiations, the union and the Chicago Public Schools agreed on a tentative contract, thereby averting the strike.
There will be classes in the morning, yes.
The proposed contract includes a limit on kindergarten through second grade classroom sizes, a cost of living raise, and an agreement on pensions. The Chicago Tribune reports that tax increment financing, funds generated from special taxing districts, will help pay for these changes. Mayor Emanuel and Chicago Public Schools CEO Forrest Claypool applauded the tentative agreement Tuesday morning. They said it was fair to all parties and were happy schools remained open. But it's unclear just how far the proposed contract will go towards fixing the problems at the root of the strike threat. One key grievance is system-wide understaffing. CTU member and high school history teacher Jim Staros.
There's only 100 teachers or 100 librarians throughout the whole system of 600 schools. We only have a nurse one or two days a week, a counselor one day a week. It's unbelievable how little we have as far as resources for what these kids need.
But CTU teachers aren't the only ones clamoring for the resolution of a labor dispute. Chicago is also now facing the possibility of the nation's first ever strike by charter school teachers. The UNO Charter School Network has 15 schools in Chicago, and 96% of its union members voted to authorize a strike if a contract agreement is not reached by next Wednesday. Among other demands, teachers are asking for a longer summer and to limit class size. That teachers in both systems have threatened to strike within the same month may seem like a case of strange bedfellows. But teacher Jim Staros points out that inner-city teachers in both systems face similar challenges.
I have no animosity for parents who are trying to do something better for their kids or for teachers who are doing their job. But, you know, it's a way they're trying to break the education system by pitting us against each other. And, you know, if charter schools are that fantastic overall, how come there aren't any in the suburbs? Well, how come the people with money and access aren't clamoring for these, and they're crowded into the areas where people are in the most need? If you had put that money into the public schools in that neighborhood, they'd been fantastic, and we could have hired those teachers and those parents would be sending their kids to quality neighborhood schools.
The proposed contract hammered out with the Chicago Teachers Union must be approved by the union's House of Delegates and voted on by its members. It remains unclear if the UNO Charter School Union will negotiate a similar agreement ahead of its October 19th strike deadline. Ariel Zients, FSRN, Chicago.
The struggle for indigenous rights continues on past yesterday's Indigenous Peoples Day at Standing Rock, North Dakota. 27 people were arrested yesterday as they gathered in ceremony underneath a wood frame structure similar to a teepee near the site where Dakota Access Pipe was scheduled to be laid. Approximately 100 law enforcement personnel in riot gear, wielding batons and automatic assault rifles, arrived in a convoy of patrol and military vehicles to carry out the arrests. Just before taking action to remove the peaceful protesters, law enforcement closed public roads leading to the Red Warrior Camp, where the protests were taking place. Many were prevented from joining the protesters. When asked why the roads were being blocked, one officer responded, quote, "There's a protest going on, and we don't want to add any more people to it," end quote. The charges following the arrest include engaging in a riot, criminal trespass, and reckless endangerment, reports guerrilla journalist outfit Unicorn Riot. The following sounds are taken directly from the protest yesterday as officers stood off against the peaceful protesters.
I take the prayer to that island. When I ask Mother Earth to forgive us for the two-legged people have done to this land. It wasn't the winged ones, wasn't the four-legged ones. The only ones that create this kind of sin are the two-legged. So I also ask that the Creator and the Mother say a prayer to us, all of us, you know, even the law enforcement over there. Clear their minds. Set their hearts straight. Help them to understand. Divided in that mission. So we ask Father and Father, Son, Mother Earth, Tonantiu, Tonantzin, we ask them to look kindly upon us at this time, even though we have desecrated them, that we have disrespected them in many ways, that they somehow have forgiveness for us and touch our hearts, every single heart, even the governor, touch his heart, open his mind, give him self-forgiveness for what he's done, and help him to see this clear path. And when we do that, we pray for people all to have this clear path, we're going to join each other. So I'm not trying to take anything away from what we're doing here, but all the minds of all the two-leggeds need to be helped. They need to be healthy. And when we're healthy, we can offer something greater to our Mother Earth. With this last offering that we did for you, it's called in our language, shiwit, or in English, fire. So we did that balance of that water and that fire. In that dance, we usually actually dance with the fire too and pass through it. And again, it's that respect for the element. I haven't danced it for a long time. I lost a child, and that's the last time I danced that one. But we offer that purification, that fire dance, and maybe Mother Earth can also accept that, that we're trying hard and offering that purification also. So that, I thank you again.
That was audio from yesterday's confrontation between peaceful protesters and heavily armed officers at Red Warrior Camp.
We stand together in peaceful prayer, said Standing Rock Sioux Chairman David Archambault on October 5th when the U.S. District Court announced it was postponing a decision on the stoppage of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Sunday, his prayers were not answered. October 9th, a three-judge U.S. court announced the denial of the tribe's request for an injunction that would have stopped work on the pipeline through the sacred lands. This allows construction to continue as far south as Lake Ohee on the Missouri River. An attorney for the pipeline company testifying in federal court asked for the court's permission to keep construction going to the edge of the lake. The attorney said that every month of delay costs the company $80 million. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers also announced on Sunday that it would not authorize work on Corps-owned land bordering under the Lake Ohee at this time. The Corps also requested the company to voluntarily stop construction within 20 miles of the lake.
Protesters in Iowa carried out two direct actions against the Dakota Access Pipeline last Saturday. A crowd marched up the access road in early afternoon and blocked access to the Mississippi River drill site. According to alternative media site Unicorn Riot, eight or more people were arrested, and other possibly uninvolved individuals were also taken into custody. Early in the evening, several protesters interrupted a truck belonging to the Michels Corporation, a construction contractor for the Dakota Access Pipeline. A woman then locked herself to the truck, preventing it from moving for 2 hours until the sheriff's deputies were able to remove her and free the truck. Police have been observed using pain compliance techniques to disengage protesters and have charged those arrested with criminal mischief, interference, and trespassing.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Preference at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly sunny and 65 degrees. Today in history, in 2002, President Jimmy Carter won the Nobel Peace Prize for his lifetime achievements. The quote of the day also comes from Jimmy Carter, who said, "America did not invent human rights. In a very real sense, human rights invented America."
Early Tuesday, near the northern U.S. border with Canada, protesters shut down all five pipelines through which tar sands oil flows into the country. 9 people were arrested. The actions came just 2 days after a federal appeals court denied another bid from the Standing Rock Sioux to block construction on the Dakota Access Pipeline. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
In the early morning light Tuesday, Ken Ward parked his Jeep just outside the chain-link fence surrounding a valve station, controlling the flow of tar sands oil through Washington State's Puget Sound. Using bolt cutters, Ward removed the lock and chain from an orange valve wheel at Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline, turned the valve to shut off the flow, locked it shut with a new chain and padlock, and left a bouquet of bright yellow sunflowers, all while recording his actions with a body-worn camera.
Hello. Good morning.
Are you with Kendall Morgan?
I am not.
Who are you with?
I'm myself, Ken Ward.
Ward is one of 5 parents and grandparents who shut down 5 pipelines across 4 northern states.
Okay. Right now you're under arrest for trespassing.
Okay.
Afrin Sapariwala is with Climate Direct Action, the group that organized the coordinated shutdowns.
We are acting in response to the call to action from Standing Rock for escalated response and prayers and actions, and this is in solidarity to them.
But even more than supporting Indigenous water defenders fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline, the shutdowns are meant to draw attention to what Climate Direct Action calls the inadequacy of global response to the climate crisis. Last week, the European Union approved the ratification of the Paris Agreement, reaching the 55-nation threshold required to implement the international climate deal. Sapariwala says it's insufficient.
We feel that even though 192 countries signed an agreement to cap climate increase to 1.5 degrees from the baseline, there isn't a single plan that is being pushed by any government or climate organization that comes close to matching this target.
The group is calling for President Barack Obama to invoke the National Emergencies Act to keep the tar sands pipelines from restarting, begin federal closure of all domestic coal and tar sands oil extraction, and introduce a concrete, financed plan to reach the global 1.5 degree goal. Monday in North Dakota, 27 people were arrested at an active Dakota Access Pipeline worksite just before locking down to a piece of heavy machinery. In a video posted by Unicorn Riot, one of 2 Standing Rock allies taking the direct action explained why.
It's my responsibility to take on violence and to take on the head of that violence, the head of that state oppression, so that folks of this land do not have to further suffer ongoing genocide that continues to happen.
Protests near the Sacred Stone and Red Warrior Camp spiked again after a 3-judge panel for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals released a ruling late Sunday night, turning down a Standing Rock Sioux request for an injunction to extend a halt on construction inside a 20-mile radius of Lake Oahe. Once again, the Justice, Interior, and Army Departments responded almost immediately after the ruling came down, issuing another joint statement reiterating the call for energy transfer partners to voluntarily continue the pause. But in a Tuesday statement, the Dallas-based company behind the 4-state, nearly $4 billion crude oil pipeline said they look forward to quickly restarting construction on the highly contested portion of the project. Nell Abram, FSRN.
The Palestinian Liberation Organization reports that 248 Palestinians have been killed in Israel since last year. The report summarizes Israel's violations committed by its occupation forces and armed settlers for over 1 year. The Palestine News Network today said the report shows that Israeli policies of annexation and colonization are creating a de facto apartheid regime. The Independent Middle East Media Center reports that 218 of the killings have been in the West Bank and 30 in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation of Palestine is entering into its 50th year.
And now for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the Community Rights Report by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos, bringing you stories of we the people reclaiming our power to govern ourselves and ending the absurdity of corporations exercising constitutional rights. I visited Standing Rock in North Dakota over this past week, and today I'm going to share with you a few observations from that visit, as well as interspersing some music from the Azteca singers and dancers Calpulli Quetzalcoatlcu, who serenaded the camp last Saturday. A month ago, when Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Caught Dakota Access private security guards on camera encouraging their dogs to attack native protectors, the Standing Rock encampment in North Dakota was jam-packed with tents and teepees. Just finding a bare piece of ground on which to set up your small tent was a challenge. But when we arrived last Thursday night, perhaps just 10% of that original group of campers was still there. The camp's in a major moment of transition now as winter is approaching. It was very chilly on our visit as the strong winds blew steadily across a mostly treeless North Dakota landscape. When the snows start to fall soon and accumulate on the ground, hundreds of native protectors plan to remain through the severe North Dakota winter. They're pulling down many of their tents and replacing them with reinforced structures with wood stoves that can better handle the approaching weather. I was quite surprised to learn that the Standing Rock camp is located not on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation, but adjacent to it, on land leased to them by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, at least until March 21st, when the lease expires. No one is exactly sure what will happen after that. I had conversations with many Native people at the camp, and one thing I kept hearing was how extraordinary it was to them that they were among hundreds of other Native nations from across North America. And also how complicated that is turning out to be, as each tribe has its own internal rules and customs, and the camp does not currently have a decision-making structure that includes representatives from each of these nations. Nothing of this scale has ever been attempted before. Overall, it was a thrilling experience for me and my three Euro-American travel partners to witness this massive and ongoing Native uprising grounded in ceremonial practice. I'm convinced that what has been started here will succeed in stopping the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and perhaps will also be an historic turning point when our nation finally cancels all new pipelines and other new fossil fuel projects. Hundreds of Native nations are now in the driver's seat to protect our waters and our climate. Mostly white environmental and climate action groups are learning how to follow their lead. It's an incredibly exciting time to witness. But we've got a heck of a lot of work to do to reach this ambitious goal. For just 30 minutes after we exited the camp this past Sunday, police cars raced by, heading back towards the camp at high speed. We found out later that their intended destination was the roadside area where the bulldozers had previously desecrated a sacred site. On Sunday, police in assault vehicles attacked Native people who were in prayer there at the side of the road. The governor of North Dakota and local county leaders continue to allow these incredible racist police assaults against Native people. I've been unable to locate any news reports to confirm the story, but I trust my source. And yesterday on Indigenous Peoples Day, at least 23 protectors were arrested as they once again blocked construction near the camp. Here's a final excerpt from the Azteca singers and dancers Calpulli Quetzalcoatlcu, who serenaded the camp last Saturday. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CienfuegosPaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Longshanks-Letigre, Al Kahn, and Kanan Schlesinger. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seaway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler host Pollen Nation Report, focusing on issues involving Native Americans. Tomorrow's show will look at sovereignty. What is, what it's based on, and how it plays out in current struggles like the one over Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. At 9 on Political Perspectives, we speak with supporters of the campaign finance measure that Multnomah County voters will be considering this November. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Anderson and guest Jim Gilbert discuss the many different ways gardeners can use leaves, harvesting fall fruits and veggies, and Jim's garden travels to Korea. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. That's the news. Night, Jenna.
Night, Kanan. Night, Wesley.
Night.
Keep it tuned to KBOO for news in depth coming up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Federal and local authorities continue to target high-profile individuals who are engaged in reporting and spreading information beyond the Dakotas. In early September, Cody Hall, spokesperson for Standing Rock's Red Warrior Camp, was arrested at a checkpoint local authorities had set up. He was held in custody for 4 days and released after he posted bail. KBOO spoke to him earlier today to gain some insight into Hall's experience and the role at Red Warrior Camp.
What do you fear is going to happen with the legal charges that Indigenous folks and allies are being charged with?
Well, a lot of these charges are based on the on a fear that from Morton County, fear of they don't know what to do. So they're just making up stuff as they go along. You know, a lot of this is a violation of civil rights, but they don't care. They just want to push through and kind of be the bully and say that these things are going to, you know, that they're the law. Nobody, you know, can supersede this law. Nobody, you know, they're the hierarchy of it all. And but they don't realize that we have lawyers that have stepped up to help take these cases on and fight these in court. And so I think that they kind of thought that they were the ruler of everything and didn't think or probably realize that we had allies, such as lawyers that were going to, kind of step up to the plate and say, you know what, you got to treat everybody fair. And just because they're protectors of the land and they want to, they want to do this and that to express their civil rights, their, civil liberties and civil freedoms, they have rights like anybody else, and they're being violated. So it's nothing to be scared of when you look at these charges. Again, we're not doing anything wrong. What we're doing is we're stepping up and we're protecting land and water. And so to us, that's not a crime. Crime is something of the nature of something heinous or so bad that you get the book thrown at you. But when we are standing up for, what we believe in, and also for what, like our burial sites that were desecrated, we have, that's our right to stand up for, for that. It doesn't scare people, to get arrested and have these charges slapped on us because we go into it with no fear. So,
is that pretty much what you would say to people who are on the cusp of getting radically involved and joining y'all over there trying to block the Dakota Access Pipeline, but are fearing reprisals and the legal ramifications of what would happen if they were to get arrested?
If they're thinking that, like, what if? The what if is really big right now because, one, everybody that's been arrested so far, that's the most that they've seen as far as cases come to Morton County in the last couple of years. They just don't have the resources to try and prosecute nearly 130 people right now. And we still have a few months left, until that permit ends. And so, that number could double. That number could kind of hover around this, maybe a few more. But either way, it's too many for Morton County to push and to think that